Hello, this is Adam S. Leslie, co-host of this very podcast. A quick plug before we start, my folk horror novel, Lost in the Garden, is now out and available in all good bookshops, including Blackwell's and Waterstones. And now, back to your regularly scheduled RetroTube.
Welcome to RetroTube, the show where bright, glossy 60s espionage goes up against grainy, spooky 70s sci-fi and reaches a truce in the weird, wonderful world of 80s cartoons. Not this week, though, as this week I am continuing my three-episode Reign of Terror. As I'm keeping a tight stranglehold on the reins as long as Adam lets me, I'm keeping us firmly in the more bizarre echelons of 60s television. However, I'm changing the pace and setting. From the bright, vivid, zany colour wheel of the 1966 Batman series, I'm transporting us back to dear old Blighty, to the poshest part of swinging London, where monochrome is the new deluxe, and where you'll find the greatest male-female crime-fighting comedy team since Adam Leslie and Heather Wainwright. When it comes to saving Britain from untold danger, duos don't come much more dynamic than John Steed and Emma Peel. That's right, folks, it's time for Series 4 of The Avengers! The Avengers is probably the most famous British spy show of them all, and ran from 1961 to 1969 over a whopping 161 episodes, initially following the adventures of Dr. David Keel and John Steed, played by Ian Hendry and the lovely Patrick McNee, agents of an unnamed secret government department. From Series 2 onward, Ian Hendry left to pursue a film career, and Patrick McNee was paired with a bevy of badass beauties, including Honor Blackman, Linda Thorson, and most famously, the delightful, delicious and lovely Diana Rigg, who played the woman with Emma Peel, Mrs. Emma Peel, in Series 4 and 5, taking the show from black and white to glorious colour with unbridled panache. Terrifyingly, it turns out that I've been a huge fan of the Peel-era Avengers for the best part of 20 years. But Adam, how familiar are you with the show? Do you have any particular memories of watching it growing up, and how did you enjoy the episodes we saw today?
Oh, wow. So many questions.
I know, I'm sorry.
I didn't watch this growing up. I had a little spurt of watching it probably 10 or 15 years ago. Probably, I think, mostly the colour episodes. I think I watched a couple of the black and white ones, but I hadn't seen many of the black and white ones at all. I think I last watched them when my friend Shannon was over. She is our Willow the Wisp correspondent, Shannon Fay.
The
author, Shannon Fay. And she was over visiting, and this ties back into our Prisoner episode, because... She made me watch The Prisoner, and I said, oh, if you like The Prisoner, you'll probably like this as well. So we watched one called, and I had to look it up, we watched Castle D'Arth.
Ah, yes, love that one.
And we were both a bit underwhelmed, I have to admit.
But it's hilarious!
Well, I think, am I right in thinking the colour ones are kind of wackier and more out there and
yes.
Stranger?
They are.
And the black and white ones are maybe a bit more formulaic. So I'd been watching the weirder, wackier colour ones. And I must have been watching them on YouTube back when you could pretty much find anything on YouTube before the copyright holders got all copyright holdery.
Yes, I remember the good old days.
I had for some reason picked the Scottish Castle one, going, oh, this is so wacky and zany. But that didn't particularly turn out to be
yeah.
It was a bit formulaic.
It's a funny episode, but it's not wacky and or zany.
So I think neither of us ever watched The Avengers again after that, which is a shame. And I think actually it's one of those shows I should watch, but I think it's mainly availability. Ironically, it's been right in front of me for months on BritBox, but in order to keep the purity of this format, I haven't watched it. And by the time we got around to watching it, it's gone off BritBox, so I haven't had the chance.
I know. I've had to invest via Amazon
actual
Video.
Actual money.
Actual real money. So you can watch it as much as you like now.
Yes, and actually, I have been watching some.
Oh, you little tinker.
So, skipping forward to the end questions, would you watch it again? I already have been.
Check you out. Well, you could knock me down with an F. That's a P.G. Woodhouse quote for you there.
Gosh, I didn't realise he was so X-rated. 18 Woodhouse. There's a cinema ratings joke for you. So, did I like it? I quite liked it. Should we say that?
Let's.
I liked some episodes more than others, but I have much fonder memories of having watched the colour episodes and them being a bit more... What's the word?
They're more fantastical, I think. And purposely so, in the colour episodes. They are more dreamlike.
Yes, I think that's what I liked about them, because I think the black and white ones can be a little bit dry, maybe.
Mm.
The last one I was watching before we recorded was The Maneater of Surrey Green, and it seemed to be a lot of the two main characters just going around and interviewing people. So they go and talk to one character and as an expert, and they'll give them information, so then they'll go to another character and they'll get information from that character. And there's a bit of running around and a bit of chasing, but an awful lot of two very posh people going to interview more posh people. But that wasn't one of the episodes, so I won't go into that. That wasn't one of the episodes that was set as homework. That was just an extracurricular episode.
Yes, that's true. So the two episodes we did watch were Death at Bargain Prices and The House That Jack Built.
Yes.
And I accidentally chose Death at Bargain Prices because I'm a bit stupid and forgot what the titles of things were.
They're quite similar.
The episode that I meant for us to watch was...
Dial a Deadly Number.
Dial a Deadly Number, that's the chap. Which is, you know, it begins with a D, so of course I was going to get confused. Because...
And it involves numbers and figures and stuff.
Like exactly.
Prices, numbers.
Yeah. It's all the same thing. I don't even know. I just know that when anybody mentions numbers, I kind of know about it in my head. So I wanted us to watch that one because Peter Bowles is in it, and you know, here at RetroTube, we have particular fondness for Peter Bowles. He's a good guy.
We do.
He's a good lad.
He is. And
a dapper chap. Yes, we miss him a lot.
We do, yes. He's passed away between now and our previous visit to Peter Bowles Land, which is obviously a terrible shame.
Yes.
I had recently watched the first episode of Only When I Laugh, and it occurred to me as I was watching it, it's probably the last ensemble 70s sitcom with all surviving cast members.
Mm.
But
not now.
Not anymore.
We didn't end up watching that because you didn't really like Dial a Deadly Number.
Well, it wasn't that I didn't like it. I had nothing to say about it.
Exactly the same as Shock in our Mission Impossible episode.
I raised a protest.
Yes, yes. I think you actually could think of a lot of things to say. But my theory on this is that you're kind of railing against the fact that I'm in charge now, and you feel that you have to, as the man of the duo, you have to tell me what my place is.
I flung myself on the floor and had a huge
tantrum.
You had tantrum.
A massive tantrum. The meltdown to end all meltdowns. And I said, oh, for God's sake, if it'll shut you up, we'll do the other one. That's not what happened, really. I would like to reassure our listeners there was no falling out at all.
I wrote a page of notes for Dial a Deadly Number, which I can tell you what they were. The opening titles, I said the cross-fading photographs is very 60s. I think it's live action in this colour one, isn't it?
Yes.
The black and white photography is gorgeous.
It is.
Is the murderer Reese Shearsmith? The dialogue is very rapid and witty, especially with Steven Peel. It reminds me of Howard Hawks movies. That kind of, you know, the really fast-paced, the man and the woman having that kind of repartee back and forth, very, you know, very tightly choreographed dialogue.
Yes.
Where there's not even a space to think, it's just like snap, 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 snap. They're so in tune with each other's sense of humour that they can.
It's like us.
Off, which I really like.
We do that all
it's
of the
like
time.
Us.
Exactly.
We do.
Oh yeah.
And I think actually one of the reasons I didn't quite take to this episode is because they spend most of it apart, again, interviewing people. So I missed that aspect of it. Also, another thing, one of the aspects I didn't like it was, I think John Steed in this, I think he's possibly a bit more chaste as in C-H-A-S-T-E, in the colour ones. In this one, he's a bit horny, and I didn't like that. So we meet Tina Packer, who we've previously met. She was Anne Travers in Web of Fear. This is one of her rare roles. She's only got like 10 entries on IMDb. And he really gives her a proper eyeing up, and I didn't like it.
I'm sure she did, though.
It made me a bit nauseous. She looked a bit peeved by it. But I sort of like John Steed being a proper gentleman rather than a bit of a pervy old 60s. But everyone in the 60s, all the men in the 60s were just constantly horny all the time, perpetually. There's an episode, I can't remember which one it is, an episode of Star Trek where there's like a moderately attractive woman walking through the corridors of the Enterprise, and all the red shirts as she's passing are kind of leaning against the walls. They can't stand upright. They just kind of have to loll about in a, you know, seductive way because a woman happens to be walking past. It's like, what's wrong with you people? And John, yeah, Steed can't control himself here.
I mean, I think there is somewhat of a difference between flirting with somebody and not being able to control yourself. I feel like I just need to just hop in defence of women who like men. We no, need to know they like, I mean, us that... somehow. We don't do telepathic signal.
I mean, they can't control themselves from flirting. It's like every woman they meet, they have to flirt outrageously. It's like, can you just not? And it's like, it's not what I want. It's not a side of Steed I want to see.
Fair enough.
Also, I didn't like, because there's a wine tasting thread in this. Quite a lot of wine tasting going, which A, I found really smug. But there's a lot of spitting in it.
Oh, yes. Yes.
And that slightly turned my stomach as well. I enjoyed the bit where Emma Peel contemptuously just spits into space. So that was quite fun. But generally these awful smug middle-aged men and their wine nonsense, they're just spitting all the time. It's horrible. So I didn't like that. Mrs. Boardman looks like Morgana Robinson. I also wrote that. But that's all I have for that episode.
Well, thank you very much for tuning in. It's been a joy. we'll see you next week.
But luckily, I insisted. So then the following episode was Death at Bargain Prices. So I let the video run on to that. And the first 5 minutes, I was like, this is more like it. This is amazing.
Yes, Death at Bargain Prices is more something you can talk about. I just feel bad that we didn't get to talk about Peter Bowles enough. But we love him a lot and we miss him. And he's a great actor. And we are big fans.
I also wrote down Peter Bowles, the most reassuring overbite on television.
That's a fact. Let's talk about Death at Bargain Prices. As you know, I am really bad at taking notes of things. I find Death at Bargain Prices, despite the fact I've seen it many, 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 many times, it's one of those episodes that I can never remember once I've seen it. And it's not that I don't like it. I just physically just don't remember it. And when I'm watching it, I'm like, oh, this is the first time I've ever seen this. Even though I know it's not the first time I've ever seen it. But my first note is that the FNARs come thick and fast in this first couple of scenes.
Oh, really?
When Emma starts her little job in the department store, Steve comes to find her to have a little chat. He says, I heard you were upstairs in ladies' underwears. In ladies' underwear. I ran up the stairs three at the time. You see, the thing is, when Steed and Peel flirt with each other, it's not creepy at all. It's just...
No, I don't mind it when it's those two, because...
They are either just really taking the mick out of each other, or they genuinely mean it because they genuinely love each other. There's a whole section of the internet dedicated to John Steed and Emma Peel being a thing. I'm here for that. So, yeah, any kind of flirting between Steed and Peel, I'm like, yes, it's love, guys. It's love. I've known it from the first. But my very favourite FNAR in this was when the house detective of the store came up to Emma and said, house dick? And she just looked at him like, excuse. And then he obviously had to explain, and she was like, oh, it's a shame. But yes, I was a fan of the FNARing.
Would you like my personal and rather sad and tragic take on the Steed Peel relationship?
If it's going to make me depressed, then no, to be honest.
I think it will, but I should say it now, I've built it up.
Go on, then.
I think for all their Jolly Repartee, I think he's desperately in love with her.
Yes.
And at the end of every episode, when she goes, ta-ra then, and goes off in her sports car, and he sort of, he looks wistfully after her, I think his little heart is breaking every time that she's going home to Mr. Peel.
She doesn't go home to Mr. Peel.
Oh, where does she go?
She just goes home. She's...
Oh, okay.
Her husband in series 4 and 5, he had a plane crash. His plane went down over the Amazon, so he was missing, presumed dead. So for all intents and purposes, Mrs. Peel was single for all of series 4 and 5. And giant spoiler alert,
her final episode.
In the first episode of series 6, Mr. Peel comes back.
I've seen Mr. Peel, yes.
Yes. And the thing that...
Should we not spoil it for people?
Adam.
Because I really enjoyed seeing it.
Adam, I'm not being funny.
Mm.
It was filmed in 1968. I think people are already spoiled. It's fine.
I don't know. I didn't know until I saw it. It was a nice little moment.
Well, I won't spoil it then.
And I thought it was rather lovely. And poignant as well.
Yes, absolutely.
For people who know what we're talking about. We've skipped over the opening scene, which is the bit that grabbed me. The director of this is Charles Crichton, the great Charles Crichton, who was movie director. We've met him before. I think he directed an episode of Man in the Suitcase that we watched, or something like that. We've seen one of his episodes before.
He directed something.
But yes, he's a film director. He directed Dead of Night, Lavender Hill Mob, Titfield Thunderbolt, Fish Called Wanda. And you can kind of tell that he's a film director because it's set in a department store. And I think this is also what separates it from Dial a Deadly Number, that it's not visually very interesting and the ideas aren't necessarily interesting. It's it's killer pagers. So the little buzzing pagers, you ring a number and then a spike comes out through your heart and you die and then there's wine tasting. And it's not super thrilling. But this one opens in a department store. It's all set in a department store. So that's a much more visually interesting place. And the opening scenes are quite trippy and surreal with the doomed agent after hours in the store going up and down in the cage lift, and he's seeing the, you know, all the mannequins in the store, and it's quite Twilight Zone. It reminded me of the Twilight Zone a lot.
Especially when after he gets shot by the evil baddie, Yogi Bear starts giggling.
There's a display of Hanna-Barbera creatures, and then before he gets shot, it's Huckleberry Hound's kind of jiggles.
I thought it was Yogi Bear.
That moment when the large Hanna-Barbera figure, whichever dog or bear it is, kind of jiggles just before the killer emerges, that's a really creepy moment as well. I really like that. It's possibly my favourite moment in any of the episodes we watched, was just that cartoon character jiggling. It's really creepy and surreal and a bit horror film kind of
creepy
thing.
Jiggle.
And I think that's something that a lot of the episodes do, even the ones that become a bit more formulaic, they often have really strong openings. One of the ones I watched in an extracurricular way was A Surfeit of H2O, which has a really creepy opening.
Yes, it does.
That's very surreal as well. It's essentially a poacher being drowned by heavy rainfall.
In one specific spot,
and he ends up gasping like a landed fish. And then later, his body has gone, but there's just a furrow in the ground in the shape where he was, and it's full of water. And that opening's really violent, and it's like a horror film. Even though it's just somebody being rained on, but it's quite horrifying. So it does sort of have a balance between is quite brutal and horrifying, particularly for 1965, for goodness sake. And then the two rather endearingly smug leads. They're very smug. Well, I quite like it. I generally object to smugness, but there's something about these two being smug that I enjoy. I don't know what it is.
They're not smug.
They are smug.
They're not. They're just posh. I have to deal with you.
We should also mention this is the slightly older sibling of Doctor Who. It's the same creator. It's Sidney Newman. Canadian television executive Sidney Newman came up with this one in 1961, and then he came up with Doctor Who for the BBC. So I think this is like the upper class Doctor Who.
Yes.
And then Doctor Who is the middle class Avengers. Like, it's the Frost Report with the three, John Cleese, Ronnie Barker and Ronnie Corbett. So you've got the Avengers is John Cleese, and then Doctor Who is Ronnie Barker, and then Columbo is Ronnie Corbett.
Can you imagine Ronnie Corbett as Columbo just going into like a big monologue about the octopus at the zoo?
I knows my place. And I think I like this episode more because it has a lot more Peel and Steed, or Steed and Peel, Steel and Peed.
Steel and Peed.
They're in it together a lot more.
And they are.
Bouncing off each other. And yeah, just their interplay and their chemistry makes it. I think you can't really, when you have two lead characters in a show, you can't really underestimate the chemistry between them. Like we saw with Fraser Hines and Patrick Troughton.
May I have some service, please? Charming. I asked the chief predator where to find you, and he said, Mrs. Peel is in ladies' underwear. I rattled up the stairs three at a time.
Mediquip's department on the fifth floor, sir.
Mrs. Peel. Our. Only been working here half a day, already enfolded to the communal bosom. Find anything?
Yes. None of the staff here have the faintest idea about running a store. Whatever they are, they're certainly not salesmen.
Fact?
Instinct.
Interesting.
What have you been doing?
Pinters were taken over a year or so ago. Lock, stock and barrel, the whole chain of stores by Horatio Kane.
King Kane?
One of the original fathers of industry.
So that's what they meant. I heard some of the staff talking about the king upstairs.
He's here?
Mm-hmm, living at the top of a building. A disused department's been converted for him.
Really? Where is it?
The Department of Discontinued Lines. You should fit in rather well.
That's a matter of opinion.
It's the top of the building, sir. Up the stairs and beyond the executive staff restaurant.
Extremely civil of you, madam. Thank you.
Patrick McNee and Diana Rigg they stayed really close friends all through the rest of their lives. And it was, again, like the Adam West Burt Ward thing, like the minute they met, it was a total love at first sight thing. And they just totally got each other, and that's how it made so much sense. We haven't seen the Kathy Gailey era of the Avengers together. As much as they got on really well, they played off each other really well on screen. It's the difference between going out and having a good time with a friend and going out and having a good time with your best friend. And you can see it on the screen. Their interactions are more intuitive than scripted.
Mm.
And it's really lovely to see them. It's lovely to see them interact in any way.
And I think there's often that physical closeness as well, and not in like a, actually not in a pervy way,
no.
But just sort of the fact that people with that kind of chemistry will just sort of naturally have the sort of physical closeness and be more interactive with each other than two people who are professional actors who get on fine, but, you know, don't necessarily have that chemistry. So you can really tell, and that does come off the screen.
Their characters, their personalities, who they are, they're deep inside of them things, their psyche, thank you.
Yes.
are similar.
Yes.
You don't realise that there's an age gap because he balances out her and she brings out his youthful side. Not that 42's old in any way, shape or form. Very young.
Very, very, very young. In fact, 47 is very young as
47
well.
47 is dead young.
47 is the new 22.
You're a kid at 47.
We have T.P. McKenna in this, a young T.P. McKenna, playing a very sinister character. We also have Alan Cuthbertson, who might not be an immediately recognisable name, but is a very immediately recognisable face.
Oh, he's been in all of
He's one of those
things.
People was just who was in everything, playing colonels, government ministers and supercilious store clerks, and he's a supercilious store clerk in this one. You would absolutely know him if you saw him. He was in every single thing possible.
He really was
playing exactly the same character
with aplomb.
I enjoyed watching someone in 1965 complaining about modern life, how rubbish modern life is and the good old days. She just goes, some things never change, do they?
They really don't.
I do have one complaint about this episode, and it's a very period-specific thing. And I think I watched 5.5 episodes in total. And rather astoundingly, this is a complaint I have about two of the episodes that I watched. The villain is in a wheelchair.
Oh, yeah.
Two whole episodes feature the villain in a wheelchair. I forget the name of the actor who plays, so he's a very, very well-known actor.
Andre Morel. In this one.
That's it. Andre Morel in that one, and in The Cybernauts, it's Michael Goff.
Yeah.
Yes. Batman's butler fella.
Yes.
I'll touch on The Cybernauts a little bit later, because it's not one of our official episodes.
It's not.
Yes, that's a bit unfortunate. I think because this is a villain in a wheelchair who's obsessed with nuclear bombs, and this is 1965, so I think this is a Doctor Strangelove reference. Doctor Strangelove was an extremely popular film, and I think quite tonally similar to The Avengers. Not completely similar, but it's out there in a similar sort of countryside. So I think, yeah, they were quite influenced by that. But I think there has been such a surfeit of...
H2O?
There's been such a surfeit over the years of disabled villains or villains with some kind of facial scarring that we just don't need it anymore.
Well, no, we don't. But I, and speaking as a disabled person, I feel like casual ableism in the 1960s just is par for the course, and it's frankly probably worse today. They just get a little bit smarter about saying it now. I mean, obviously there were an awful lot of things that are 100% wrong about the way that the 1960s dealt with various social issues, and there are styles of acting and there are certain representations that thankfully no longer exist. But it doesn't mean that the attitudes have gone in any way, shape or form. So when people, and I'm not speaking personally, I'm speaking very generally, when people talk about, you know, how racist, homophobic, ableist, etc., 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 things recorded in the past were, they never seem to note that things are just as bad now, but they're just not taking notice of it. You've got to take this sort of thing with a little bit of under advisement rather than with a pinch of salt, because there really wasn't the awareness and there wasn't the knowledge then, and they were working the best that they could with the knowledge that they had.
And I think also 60s TV was very tropey, a lot more tropey than it is now.
Yeah, there was an awful lot that the television viewer could deal with back then. They expected, their standards were not the same as they are now.
Now people should know better.
People should know better now. And that makes when you see, like, for example, on Twitter in the last few days, I've been trying to get recommendations for decent Latinx representation in television shows, and nobody can help me because there's hardly any. And this is a big thing. This isn't just a thing that I'm noticing. This is a thing among Latinx actors and directors and etc. Everybody seems to be either part of a gang, an illegal immigrant, part of a drug cartel.
A housekeeper,
a nanny. There's nobody. There are very few examples in current media now of good Latinx representation of Latinx people just being people living their lives and going home and making tea. And I know things like going home and making tea and just going to work aren't particularly, like, acting-worthy or television show-worthy, but...
Just having the stories that white people would have.
Having the stories that white people would have. But things like this aren't happening now, so it's difficult to be too angry at the fact that correct representation and wholesome representation of disabled people, LGBT people, BIPOC people, that we didn't get it back in the 60s. It's very difficult to be upset, to be so upset about it, because we're still not getting it, is the point that I'm making in a very roundabout way.
Yes, it's tropiness, but it is unfortunate that it's two wheelchair villains within such a short space of time.
Yeah, it's not nice. And I speak as a person who can't walk very well and needs to use walking aids. It makes you mad, it makes you angry, but it certainly doesn't turn you into a supervillain. If only it did.
Yeah, I think one you could see as careless, but two within four episodes, like, oh, another one. I think also from the episodes of series four that I've watched, it's very, very formulaic. Like the villain from the Cybernauts and the villain from the house that Jack built have pretty much an identical motivation.
Yes.
And most of the villains have some kind of technological thing. It's essentially posh people trying to stamp out technological innovation.
Posh people don't like it up 'em.
You know, they have different combinations of the same ideas every week. What I will say is that these shows have some great guest casts.
They really do.
A Surfeit of H2O has both Jeffrey Palmer and Talfrin Thomas, a great combination.
Your favourite.
In anyone's books. I do like a bit of Talfrin Thomas. The Cybernauts has everyone. It has Bert Kwok.
Literally everyone.
It has Bernard Horsfall. It has John Hollis, the baldy fella from Empire Strikes Back, who's always great, and he turns up in a lot of things. It's great seeing sort of younger versions of all these people familiar from 70s TV cropping up with their dark, brill-creamed hair.
Yeah, we like a bit of that.
So we should probably sort of, we've been going a long time, haven't really described the plot of Death at Bargain Prices, although the plots of these are very similar. This is about... He's like an evil scientist, or is he kind of an evil engineer?
Yes.
A lot of the time, aren't they? They're sort of into technology. Department stores are always a great place to set something like this because they just look great, particularly in the 60s.
Yeah, you don't get a department store these days, really.
Not so much, no. They're looking for a nuclear bomb hidden inside the department store. Then they realise the department store is the bomb. So that's quite neat. Mm-mm-mm. And there's a scene where that... holding a professor captive.
Yes.
We think it's a... or at least I thought it was a flashback to the jungle, but actually it's a jungle diorama inside the department store and it's not a flashback. That's quite cool.
Yes, they threaten him with a succulent.
They do. I'd be most perturbed if I was threatened with a succulent.
We've all been there.
Many times. Also, this has toy Daleks in it! Hooray!
Toy Daleks.
Louis Marx Daleks. I'm sufficiently nerdy. I mean, I don't think there are any other toy Daleks in 1965 apart from the Louis Marx ones. But the Louis Marx ones were instantly recognisable because the shape is wrong. Their heads are too small. They come to too much of a point. So they are very distinctively Louis Marx Daleks. They don't look like Daleks. They look like themselves. And they did occasionally crop up in Doctor Who as, you know, if they needed masked Daleks... they'd just buy a bunch of Louis Marx toys, but you could tell them because they look wrong. They're the wrong shape. But it's great seeing them out of context in the toy department.
Steve gets beaten up by the baddies and goes to visit Emma. And he's like, I've been mortally wounded.
And she, pull yourself together, son.
She is so much like, he is there all, please give me sympathy and love. Please kiss my hurt better. And she's like, oh, for God's sake. It's only a black eye. just get over yourself, Steed, love. And she gives him some, like, eye wash, and he's like, that's not what I meant. And you kind of feel a bit sorry for it, because it is quite a shiner.
He just wants a cuddle.
He just wants a cuddle, and who...
but he's too shy to ask for one.
Who wouldn't want to cuddle Steed? That's my question. He understands the concept of champagne and chocolate in the female psyche, and frankly... that man is a keeper. He dresses well.
And who wouldn't want to cuddle from Emma Peel?
Exactly. I 100% would have a cuddle from Emma Peel. No letters on that, please, guys. That's not what I meant.
Whatever happened to you?
Department of Discontinued Lines. Wentworth threw me out.
I've got just what you need.
I'm thinking of lodging a complaint against the management. Proves one thing, though. They must have something to hide.
Jarvis thinks so, too. House detective. He's agreed to help. Cheers.
I expected a larger glass. No.
Really, Steve, the fuss you make over a tiny bruise.
Tiny? What on earth's that?
Oh, it's an exploded molecular construction.
So that's what hit me. Oh, I feel as though I'm sprouting two heads.
Have you room for expansion?
You're supposed to be a ministering angel. Here am I, grievously hurt.
Bruised.
My pride was hurt.
Come now. Surely you've been thrown out of places before.
Only the best places.
You will survive. Ugh. Would you like a drink?
Intravenously.
Those are the bits I like watching. It's just them interacting and their quips. I can take or leave the plot.
It's like having a little giggle with each other. And
I like her weird fighting style. She does this weird... finger clicking thing.
Yes, I made a note about it.
It's very strange. I don't know what that was.
She just snaps her fingers and then does weird kicking things and manic gesticulation rather than actual karate chops. It's just very dramatic hydrogen. Flinging her hands up in frustration.
Yeah, I don't know if this is a Diana Rigg thing.
Nobody has ever karateed in that way before or since. It's quite strange. And speaking of strange fighting styles, John Steed is the most middle-class fighter a fighter has ever been, because he is the only man on earth who would bring a cricket bat to a knife fight.
No, he's definitely upper class.
He is.
You can tell he's upper class because he can fight.
He can fight, and he's not afraid to fight. He's like, I don't care if I get a rip at my suit. I can just take it down to my fella on Savile Row. He'll sort that out in a gym.
Yeah, he's the original Kingsman.
He is the original Kingsman, but with more class. Sorry, Colin Firth, not sorry at all.
Before we get onto the final one, the house that Jack built, maybe we'll mention that I watched the Cybernaut extracurricularly, mainly because I'd seen a clip of it. I'd seen the ending scene years ago and found it really frightening.
How can it possibly have frightened you when it's basically just a rip-off of the Cybermen?
No, it's pre-Cybermen.
The Cybermen was a rip-off of the Cybernauts?
Yes. Yeah, the Cybermen, I think, would be... This was 1965. The Cybermen would be 1966. I think they'd be 1966. They're the final William Hartnell story the Cybermen first appear in. And they're quite different. They're much more human in that. They have human hands and cloth faces, and they're a lot creepy. And they have weird... sing-song voices that I can't quite do a good impression of. The later Cybermen were more sort of manly, and they talk like this. No, Doctor, it is you who will die. Mm. But the early Cybermen talked more like this.
We were exactly like you once, but our cybernetic scientists realised that our race was getting weak.
Weak? How?
Our lifespan was getting shorter, so our scientists and doctors devised spare parts for our bodies until we could be almost completely replaced.
Silly little me, I dropped my toast in full.
So they were a stranger thing back then. Whereas, the Cybernauts are more robots. But, yeah, I think it's that chopping thing they do, that karate chopping stuff, and just the relentlessness of it. And, when I saw this clip of this when I was little, and when they start chopping at each other, I found it really scary. The scene in the warehouse at the end, I have this vivid memory of finding it really scary. And I think because, also, at that time I would have been aware of the Cybermen, obviously, and they were quite comfortably science fiction. Whereas I think that Avengers episode, or certainly out of context, just the end scene, looked much more like real life. It didn't look like fun sci-fi. It looked like a serious drama with these chopping robots in it. Horrible. Yeah.
I see.
Scary. So that bit was quite good. It also... Poor old Michael Goff. He turned up in a Doctor Who story called The Celestial Toymaker, which has had a lot of criticism over recent years for Orientalism.
I see.
And he turns up in an episode of The Avengers, which is stuffed full to the rafters with Orientalism.
That's
so
not
he
what you
can't
want.
Catch a break.
It's not what you want.
And it has Bert Kwok, who at least is an actual East Asian actor.
Yeah.
But he's
from Warrington.
He does say... Yes, he's of East Asian descent,
yes.
And he does say at one point, "We have a saying." Like, no, they had a Japanese character say, "We have a saying."
Oh no!
And they say honorable a lot and things.
Oh,
like that. Again,
no!
Again, it's 60s tropiness.
Yeah, it happens so much in so many things, and it's embarrassing.
It is. The actual stuff with the Cybernauts themselves was really good, but the rest of the episode wasn't. And the whole bit with all the karate instructor and everything. Oh, it's a bit painful. There was a lot of karate-based padding. The Cybernauts themselves were really frightening. Just the relentlessness of them smashing through doors and
their
blank, weird faces.
They didn't care.
And their big eyes that are slightly too far apart. And they wear hats.
They wear hats.
Cybermen don't wear hats.
They should. They should. Imagine Cybermen with fedoras or tam o'shanters.
And they wear really nice. They wear really nice overcoats as well. These Cybernauts. So that was quite.
They're more fashionably conscious than the Cybermen.
They go around in wetsuits with plastic balls glued to them.
You did not think that through.
I was trying to think of what... They're not ping pong balls, but they're those balls with holes in.
Right. Okay. I never expected for a moment that while recording about Avengers, we would start talking about the Cybermen's balls. But here we are.
The plastic balls.
So, this brings
us on. I'm just
knocking
the headphones off.
Oh, for God's sake.
I'm not even drunk.
Wow, check you out. So this now brings us on to the house that Jack built. And now this was the one that was a bit of a no-brainer for me because it's certainly my favourite monochrome episode of The Avengers. But I also thought that you would love it because of how head-screwy he is. Yes, would you like to give us a little premise of what goes on here and then you can tell me how wrong I am.
So this episode is about Emma Peel receives a letter to say that she has inherited a house from an uncle she didn't know but who has died. She didn't know he existed, but he's left her a house in his will.
Nice.
She goes off to this house,
mm-hmm.
and inexplicable things happen. She gets her head thoroughly messed with in this house.
She absolutely very does.
And I would say this is much more like it. This is much more up my street.
I told you. I knew it. Knew it.
It's like, oh, this is what I want to see.
Mm.
This feels like it's much more like the Colour Ones.
Yes.
It's not formulaic like the others, so it doesn't open with a murder. It doesn't have the two characters going around to different experts interviewing them. There aren't really other characters in it particularly. I mean, there's a couple of other characters in it, but there aren't characters in locations who they have to go and visit.
No.
It's pretty much all taking place in this one house. Even though I already said that I didn't like the first one particularly because the two characters, Steel and Peed, weren't in it together. Actually, this is mostly Emma Peel on her own with very little John Steed. But the actual episode itself is so different and unusual that it doesn't matter because it's really keeping your attention.
There are many things I like about this episode. I would say, like, that visually, the thing I really liked about it was the room. You know, where she kept on turning around and she was, no matter where she went.
The recurring room.
No matter where she was in
the
house.
Two notes.
Yes. The buzzy room.
Yeah, so every time she keeps going down these corridors and every door she goes to, she always ends up back in the same room, which is actually something I use a lot in my writing, is this kind of space apparently folding in on itself.
Yeah, and it doesn't even matter if she goes to a different room. Like, even if she just turns around in the same room and then turns back again, she's back in this room, which is the most 60s room that has ever existed. And I can't explain it any better than that, but it has got the essence of the mid-1960s swinging London. That's what that room looks like. That's just what it looks like.
But it's quite
like.
Creepy
That's what
as
it
well.
Is. It's very creepy. And it works so much better in black and white. I think the black and white lends itself to this episode so well because...
I was just about to say, I so wish this was in colour.
Oh, wow,
just because
really?
It would be beautiful.
I mean, it probably would be.
I think it's good in black and white because it's like the Twilight Zone, and this is very tonally like the Twilight Zone. It's a character being driven to their wit's end, and we'll get onto that. But I think it would also look utterly beautiful in colour.
It would look beautiful in colour, but I think atmospherically, it feels more monstrous and unworldly in black and white. It feels more like a 1960s, inverted commas, modern take on a psychological horror of the 40s. So it works so much better in a film noir kind of colour setting.
And I think, unlike the other episodes, which are very plot-heavy, in fact, possibly my main complaint is they're a little bit too plot-heavy. This one almost has no plot at all.
It's just literally all about
Emma
Mendel.
Yeah, which I think is really good. It's much more cinematic and much more... In its own way, it's quite repetitive, but that's the point. It's the same thing keeps happening over and over, and that's what's driving her spare.
Yes. The thing I like especially in this episode, and this isn't a thing that is peculiar to this episode. This is certainly a theme of Steed and Peel's relationship. Steed doesn't save Emma.
Right.
Steed knows Emma can take care of herself. Steed will go out to help. He will go out to give her support if she needs it, but Steed knows that Emma can take care of herself. And that is a 1960s attitude that you don't see in many other shows. For example, The Champions, which we still haven't watched, but we will do one day, I promise. Craig and Richard will often, particularly Craig, will often say to Sharon McCready, let us guys deal with this, you just keep your pretty head down. There is none of that with John Steed. John Steed would never say that to any woman, ever. Even when it's a complete innocent character, she has absolutely no idea of what's going on, and she really does need helping and saving. He won't say anything like that. He will allow a woman to use her own agency to take care of herself, and he will be there as support, not because he's a man who can swoop in and save the day, but because he just is a person who is there to help. And that is such a refreshing thing, and it is a thing you would not expect from an upper class middle-aged man in the 1960s. And that this is more why I love John Steed than anything else, because he's a very modern man living inside a very, very old-fashioned suit.
Yes. Well, sort of old-fashioned, but also it's Pierre... Is it Pierre Cardin?
Yeah.
So it's Savile Row tailoring. It's modern Savile Row tailoring, but
beautiful,
for your city gent.
Beautiful clothes.
Mm. But what I'll also say about the writing of Emma Peel in this episode is that they allow her to be scared. And I think that's a thing that often trips up a lot of modern writers, is that you have the kick-ass woman, but she can only be kick-ass.
The strong woman trope, yeah.
Yes. She can only be, like, sassy and smart, and she'll kick your bottom. But in this, they allow her to be scared. And we see this character who is almost never scared.
Yeah.
And this is the episode where you do actually see her start to... She starts to lose her cool. And at the beginning, she's doing her usual thing of being a bit too cool for school, and also too old for school. But she's doing her usual thing of you know, having a bit of a one-liner to herself. But as it goes on, she's clearly losing her cool, gradually, just bit by bit, and you see her start to be actually scared and start to be actually rattled and look really worried. But then she comes out the other side of it and pulls herself together and says, no, there has to be an explanation for this. And then she works out.
She does.
And she doesn't need Steed to come in and go and be all, you know, he doesn't come in and be the doctor and go, I'll tell you what's going on.
No.
But that's the thing, yes. So they allow her to go through being scared. And the whole idea of this house is to make her lose her marbles, and she does start to.
She does.
And even after she's started to think, right, I can work this out, she does still start to, you know, she doesn't 100%
trust what's going on around her.
No. The strong female character trope, it's a misunderstanding of what that means. It means, you know, it means a strongly written character. It doesn't mean that she has to be Ellen Ripley.
No, not at all. And really, the strength of a woman, I feel for myself personally, speaking as a woman, the strength in a woman is being scared and doing the thing anyway.
Yes.
Because women have got a lot more reserve than anybody gives them credit for. We have got an awful lot of things to deal with just in society in general. And just being a woman is a terrifying thing sometimes. Not even a woman being put into a situation where it's specifically designed to make her lose her mind. Just the general day-to-day aspect of being a woman in a world full of men, really. It's difficult. It's scary. It's scary if you're a gay woman, if you're a trans woman, if you're a career woman, if you're a housemaker, if you're, you know, being a woman isn't easy. And many, many times, women do not have anybody to save us. Women, we have to save ourselves. We have to keep going. We have to be the strong ones for ourselves, for our families, for our friends. We have to be the support. And the fact that we get to see Emma, who is, we know that she's very, very intelligent. We know that she's absolutely badass. We know...
Usually unflappable.
She's usually unflappable. She's beautiful. She's very well put together. She has great dress sense. She's got an awful lot of great things going for her. Emma Peel is terrified. If Emma Peel can be terrified and can still carry on and can get the stuff done, any woman can carry on and get the stuff done, because Emma Peel can do it, so we can do it. And I just think Emma Peel is one of the most important female characters that have ever been invented. And that is the very tiny hill I'm going to die on.
Oh, I think that's a fairly decent-sized hill.
Thank you.
I think what's also interesting about the character development of Emma Peel as an actual character in the show is we see a completely different side of her. Not just her being scared, but we get a lot of backstory where we find out she was Emma Knight.
Yes.
That's her maiden name.
Yes.
And she wasn't always a leather-clad villain fighting person. She was a young industrialist.
She most certainly was. One of the first notes I have got after she leaves Steed developing photos in his flat. Just holiday snaps, guys, nothing weird. is that she is accosted by a creepy version of Pat from Ghosts. He says to her, "Oh, it's Kim Wilde."
I like how strange it is. Yeah, I just wrote a list of the things that were happening. A key with electronic properties, a giant enigmatic scout, a spy camera in The Verge, a moving sign. So it's much more mysterious than most of the episodes.
Yes. The changing signpost was very anxiety-inducing. And then when the road closed, I was like, oh no, they're never going to find her. They're never going to find her. They're never going to find her.
There's a music box, stuffed animals.
All of the things.
The giant scout has a gun.
Nobody wants that.
No.
Oh, and then I say, whatever she does in the house, she always ends up back in the weird buzzy room. And then she finds Pat actually dead on the table. So then she does the only thing any self-respecting 60s lady would do in this situation. She pours a giant feck-off brandy and thinks to herself. Then figures out the mechanism of how the rooms work. If all else fails, just pour a giant brandy. And I love the fact...
Have a big brandy.
I love the fact that not only did she... And this is a thing that I really have a lot of respect for. I think this is potentially an autistic thing for me. I am a stickler. And you can ask any member of my family and they will tell you I am horrendously anal about this.
Uh-oh.
I need to have the correct receptacle for any beverage that I have.
Really?
I need
to have the
correct...
I'm the exact
opposite. No, if it's not the right glass, I can't drink it. It doesn't matter if it's the nicest drink in the world. If you've not given it to me in the right glass, I can't. I just can't drink it. I will go and get the correct receptacle and then decant it from one to the other. I have to drink out of a specific glass. But whenever anybody in 60 shows needs a brandy, a brandy glass always appears. And I'm like, yes, this is how these things should be done. If you're going to have a drink, do it properly. This entire house is rigged up to make Emma lose her mind, but they make sure that they have brandy and brandy glasses. If they were making me lose my mind, they'd give me a bottle of brandy and two scotch glasses. And I'd be like, what the hell?
Everyone in this is very sophisticated, though. It feels a lot like The Prisoner, and how much more would I have liked The Prisoner if it had a character in it that I cared about?
Yeah, that is genuinely the problem with The Prisoner. I mean, as you know, it's one of my favourite shows ever, but number six is so unlikable.
If Mr. Peel was The Prisoner, it probably would be one of my favourite shows ever.
But no, it's the most terrifying man in history. Patrick McGowan.
Being all severe in that.
Yeah, being just like glaring at everybody. And
I also said, this is more like what I was expecting from the Avengers. Not all those interviews.
Steed falls for the old road close sign at first, but he's no fool. He drives straight through the sign and then pats his Bentley in a congratulatory way just before the tyres are all sabotaged and blown out like.
To the bit where she keeps going into the recurring rooms and she finally... After a few times around, there's the machine, the whirly machine in the middle with the perspex glass dome over the top. So to see if it's the same room, to see if it's the same room or different rooms, she takes out her lipstick to put a mark on it, and I thought, now this will be. I did actually consciously think this as it was happening. This will be interesting to see whether she does something kind of a bit smart and smug and arch, like what she what. the mark she puts on it is some kind of like some kind of arch Avengers-y thing, like, because like on her front door she has an eye.
Yes, she does.
She doesn't just have a spy hole like normal people. She has an actual big eye, which I do. But it's very arch. It's very Avengers.
I would really love to have that on my front door. I don't know if my landlord would let me. If you're listening, not. Landlord, please may I have a giant eye on the front of my door. I live in a corner. Nobody would see it, but I would be happy knowing that it was there.
She's taken out her lipstick. She's going to put a mark on this. Is it going to be something smart and arch and Avengers-y? And she puts an X. I thought, right, she's really rattled. This is how we know she's rattled. She just puts an X. She doesn't draw a picture of a bowler hat or something like that.
Just an X.
It's just starting to get genuinely claustrophobic, which I liked. Another thought was, I bet John Steed was an influence on John Pertwee's Doctor. There's a bit where he has a little smile to himself and he pats his vintage car affectionately.
Yeah.
And that's such a Pertwee move.
He pats his Bentley.
At this point, it would be William Hartnell would be the Doctor who's worlds apart from John Steed. Like, they would be totally opposite characters. But I think Pertwee, he's often seen as being that kind of adamant sort of character. And I think there's a lot of Sherlock Holmes in him. I think he's very John Steed. Like, looks-wise, he's very different, and dress-sense-wise, he's very different, because he's velvet jackets and frills and capes and things like that, so he's not the city gent type. I think he's more John Steed than he is First Doctor.
Oh, yes. I mean, I'm saying oh, yes, but I've never actually seen any John Pertwee Doctor Who.
No.
I mean yet, because I know that there is so much more Doctor Who in my future. I have got it all to look forward to.
And you will love it.
I can't wait.
You will love it. Pertwee's a lot grumpier and more unpleasant than Steed, but he's a bit flash. So Emma Peel goes into a room and there's a sign which says, and this I really liked, "Welcome to an exhibition dedicated to the late Mrs. Emma Peel." That's nice. That's very Twilight Zone as well. Anything that kind of evokes that Twilight Zone feel for me is a winner.
Yeah, I mean, obviously I've not seen Twilight Zone because I know it's one that you're going to make.
That will be in your future as well, yes.
Yeah, which is kind of why I've avoided the Twilight Zone in the last, like, 18 months or so. But it's also quite... it's very A Christmas Carol.
Oh yeah, I guess so, yeah.
The whole Ebenezer Scrooge gravestone and gloating over his death kind of...
The villain in this is doing that sort of thing, isn't he? He's...
Yeah, yeah.
Because she does see lots of relics from her childhood and old photographs in this museum exhibition, but it's very, very strange, which I'd like about it. It's unexpected. It's what... And I think I like... things where you don't know what's going to happen next. It's genuinely surprising.
No, and a thing that you really don't expect to happen next is for a random escaped convict to just turn up and start singing or reciting "The House That Jack Built."
"This is the bull that tossed the horse, that kicked the cow, that chased..." "Dog. That bit the cat, that killed the rat, that lived in the house that Jack built. Jack built, Jack built, Jack built."
"Who are you?"
"Chase the dog. Dog."
"What is your name? Who are you?"
"Bad man. Bad, bad, bad man. Ran away."
"How did you get here?"
"Ran away. Long time ago. Very long time ago."
You don't expect that. But let me tell you, that's what happens.
That's what happens. That actually reminded me, the neck bone connected to the head bone. It reminded me a bit of that.
From The Prisoner. Yeah. By Alexis Kanner.
Yes, it's very Prisoner, this one. That's Griffith
My
Davis.
My prisoner, not your prisoner.
Yes. Griffith Davis is the escaped convict. He's very good.
He is very good. He's very good.
He's been trapped in this house and he has lost his marbles. So I think he's there in order to show the peril that she's in. He's someone that's been there before and it has driven him say.
Yeah, I feel as though this, he was just, he's just an innocent bystander, really, because obviously this was all concocted and put into place for Emma specifically. But because we saw right at the beginning of the episode this guy just escaping from prison, he just sought shelter in the nearest big house, and this is what's happened to him because he got himself caught in Emma's trap.
Yes.
So he's very much collateral damage.
And he's an extra bit of peril because sometimes he's pitiful, but sometimes he's aggressive.
Yes, which makes the immediate threat to Emma even scarier.
Mm.
It really, this episode messes with your head so much in a way that you would not expect from
1965.
60s television.
You might expect something like this in 1967 or 68, but this is 1965.
This is when London is very swinging.
This is pre-psychedelia.
Total pre-psychedelia. Just everybody's having a nice time. Everybody's having a lovely time. The Beatles have got lovely hair.
They're all stoned off their noggins, but
it's not gone weird.
George doesn't look like a witch.
I was just about to say that. Oh my god!
That's your quote.
They were literally the next words out loud. George is not looking like a witch. But the thing is, I mean, like, you're giggling at me, but you know what I mean.
Like, this is one of your prime quotes from the Magical Mystery Tour episode.
I thought that was like my biggest throwaway quote. When George starts looking like a witch,
yeah,
I know,
right. Pout. Yeah.
But it's true.
Patrick McNee is quite conspicuously not on location. So there's lots of back projection, which actually in black and white works all right. There's a man dressed in a bowler hat and a nice coat we see hopping about in the foliage, but only from behind.
Mm. And we all say to ourselves, that's not Patrick McNee's bottom.
That's not Patrick McNee's bottom.
I don't think anybody has ever said that.
I said it in my George. That's not Patrick McNee's bottom.
It's a bit silly.
It's a bit silly. What? What? Which line is it from Hard Day's Night that he delivers in that?
That's not your grandfather.
Oh yeah, that's not your grandfather.
But
that's,
I've seen
not
your grandfather.
But I've seen Patrick
house.
McNee's bottom.
Whoa, he lives in your in house. House. You weren't supposed to tell anyone.
Well, everyone's entitled to, and that's me other one.
And we're looking after it. Anyway, we can't let this disintegrate at this stage into a Hard Day's Night again.
Yeah, my final note on the episode is that it really feels like she's been through something by the end of it. And she,
yeah.
And it's quite nice that she does. I think she doesn't want to appear vulnerable in front of Steed, so she does snap out of it and go back to quipping immediately, and she does sort of like a little snarky put down. I can't remember exactly what it is, but I'm sure I'll drop in the quote.
What happened to the shining armour?
It's still at the laundry. Never mind. I'll give you a ride home on the old horse.
I think that also is another thing that makes her a nice rounded character, that she has, not actually a flaw, but I think it's, she doesn't want to appear vulnerable in front of him, and she's maybe a bit embarrassed to appear vulnerable, so she's back. She just snaps out of it, and she's back into quipping mode, even though she has been through something quite full on.
She is. There's an unspoken moment. There's certainly a look between them where he knows that she has been through something really profound, and she looks exhausted and terrified, and there is a horrified look in her eyes. There's some beautiful non-verbal acting going on between Diana and Patrick, although he doesn't say anything to her and she doesn't say anything to him. They both know that something big has happened, and maybe at some point in the future she will speak about it, but for now it's enough for her that it's over and she can go home. And he can just give her a cuddle.
He knows she doesn't want to talk about it as well. Like, he doesn't...
Yeah, and it's like, it's fine that you don't want to talk about it. Maybe one day. So
he knows she just wants to banter, so he's happy just to banter.
Just to banter, yeah. That's the definition of the best friend ever.
Yes.
What a guy. We love John Steed in this house.
So, yes, that was much more like it. That's more like it.
That's what you wanted from your 60s television.
From the Avengers, goodness sake.
Absolutely. Yeah. I knew you'd like that one, I told you. So, that was the Avengers. So, I need to ask you a few little questions.
You certainly do.
Who was your favourite and least favourite character?
I mean, on one hand, you have Steel and Pede, who I think are equally as good.
Yeah.
And then on the other hand, you have quite an array of tropey 60s characters.
You do.
Who are a bit interchangeable.
And Pat from Ghosts, randomly.
Pat from Ghosts. Yeah, he was quite cool.
Yeah.
I think taking it for granted that they're two of the best characters to have appeared on TV ever, I think my favourite character was probably the weird, mysterious giant Boy Scout, Pongo.
I might have killed you.
The speed you were going... The stopping distance of this car is 147 feet, allowing for average reflexes. I position myself 150 feet away.
Very mathematical of you.
I am a very mathematical person.
You're also very stupid. Supposing I hadn't seen you.
In that case, my death would have been entirely your fault. I would like a lift, please.
You give me the fright of my life, and then you have the audacity to ask a favour. Where to?
As far as you are going. I should say that I'm desperate to obtain a lift. Desperate enough to... recompense you for your trouble.
That won't be necessary. Get in.
And next week in Food Club, we're going to hear from Kitty about the first time she ate an egg. I didn't think I'd like it. Yes. Sorry.
You do all of them. You do impressions for all of them.
I am so sorry. So, your favourite and least favourite episodes... Out of the two, not out of the 5.5.
Oh, well, I mean, I think we've already answered that one.
Have we? Because you kind of like both of them.
Oh, yeah, no, I mean, the House at Jack bit was definitely much more like it.
Yeah, it's a good one, isn't it?
It is, yes.
Let's be fair. And what are your favourite and least favourite elements of the show?
The best elements are... I think there's two things. The black and white photography looks great, particularly as someone who is actually more used to watching the multi-camera shows. I mean, it's like a hot... You can't... It's difficult to comprehend the fact that season 2 or 3 of Doctor Who is concurrent with what we just watched.
Oh, crikey, no.
Because the studio shows are so murky and prehistoric looking, and this looks like it was shot yesterday.
You can tell there is such a bigger budget for the Avengers than for Doctor Who.
Yes, it's not just some people in a tiny set with 4 cameras pointing at them and blurry shapes in this soupy murk.
Yes.
It's actually a lot less looks blurry. Like a feature film. There's a few occasions where the boom creeps into shot, so that kind of
cheers you up a bit.
Yeah. It's like, oh yeah, no, I know where I am.
it's
not perfect.
There it is.
There's the boom. Hello. Hello, cheeky.
There's a
cheeky little glimpse. Oh, hello.
Oh, I saw a wall wobbling when he fell into it. Oh, yeah.
Yes, there's a bit where it's kicking at a wall and it has a right old wobble.
It does.
I tell you, there's more so wobbly walls in this than there is in Blake 7 and Prisoner.
I like a shaky set.
Yeah, I don't care about the shaky set. They don't do it deliberately.
I think it adds to it.
But yes, I like the photography and I like the central characters the best, obviously. I think my least favourite elements would, again, like last week, just it's a bit too formulaic. When it breaks that and we do something like the house that Jack built, it's like we're improper. This is what I'm expecting from the Avengers and not...
This is what you want.
Yeah, this is what I want. And I feel like a hypocrite saying it because one of the shows I've been binge-watching lately has been Columbo, which only works because it's incredibly formulaic. And it is a man just going around between people... interviewing them. But I think what's different And why it doesn't quite work here, and I think I prefer the Avengers when it's being more far out, is that they're just going around these people getting information. And watching the Man-Eater of Surrey Green, my attention was starting to wander, I'll have to admit. Whereas in Columbo, it's also mind games. So it's not just...
Very much, because everybody underestimates Columbo, don't they? Everybody thinks, oh, with this little thick Italian guy. And he's absolutely not.
No, he's incredibly smart. He plays bumbling. He is the Patrick Troughton of police detectives. But yes, it's not just a police procedural. It is actually about him using these interviews to dismantle the psyche and get these people to crumble and make mistakes. So that's what's compelling about it.
Brother Nigel paints the stairs with the signs of the zodiac. Throws paint in the mirror as he stands in his plastic mat. Sister Emma rises ever round and round the garden. Spends the whole day saying, I beg your pardon.
Thank you very, very much for watching 972 episodes of The Avengers, even though I only asked you to watch two. Thank you, everybody, for listening in. Again, to me, having another go. I'm very excited about this. And next week is my final week of me being in charge of RetroTube, if Adam lets me.
Absolutely.
I'm going to give you a little clue as to what we're going to be talking about next week. My clue is the word energize. There he goes, acting all illogically.
This is the house that Jack built, baby, and it reaches up to the
If you have enjoyed the episode, and we really, really hope you have, and if you would like to tell us about it, you are more than welcome to get in touch. We would love to hear from you. We are on Twitter. Our username is @retro_tube. And if you are not a fan of Twitter, because let's face it, it's a bit of a silly place.
It's a bit stressful.
It's a bit stressful. You can always email us. You can always email us. Our email address is retrotubepodcast@gmail.com. And we will always reply. We're always happy to hear from you. And I think that's pretty much all that I can think of to say with my mouth.
Uh-oh.
Do you have the final word, Adam Stewart Leslie?
This is Adam S. Leslie, co-host of this very podcast. My folk horror novel, Lost in the Garden, is now out and available in all good bookshops, including Blackwell's and Waterstones. Don't talk to strangers, don't play on the farm, and don't go to Almonby. Heather's on-off boyfriend Stephen has gone to the mysterious village of Almonby. He went for 2 weeks, and no one has seen him in 6 months. The only trace of him which remains is his voice, distantly calling for help, drifting across the fizz of shortwave radio. With a couple of friends in tow, Heather sets off through a warped, distended version of the English countryside, baking in perpetual summer, to track Stephen down, and to find out for herself why everyone says, don't go to Almonby. Author Eric LaRocca called Lost in the Garden eerily enchanting and profoundly inventive, a dreamy and unsettling masterwork. This is one of the freshest and most spiritually rewarding novels I've read in quite some time. And author Matt Wasilowski described it as like trying to recall a troubling and beautiful dream. It's like peering through a wound in the world, sorrowful and uncanny and utterly stunning. This book is magnificent, like nothing I've ever read before. Thank you, Matt and Eric. Lost in the Garden by Adam S. Leslie, published by Dead Ink Books, priced at $10.99. Look for the pink and white cover.